You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 14th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're picking apart pegged currencies and considering how the mechanisms and structures behind them come under pressure during times of market turbulence. We look at some contemporary problem areas and recall some notable historical examples of mechanisms that have unravelled. We start with Paul Donovan, Deputy Head of Global Economics at UBS Investment Bank. Paul provides some background outlining why pegged currencies exist and some of their potentially positive impacts.
So pegged currencies come really with two possible motives. So the first is a legacy, basically. We used to have fixed exchange rates under the Bretton Woods system, and some countries basically maintained their ties to other currencies after Bretton Woods broke up. So a lot of countries which had political ties, perhaps to a former imperial power, would quite often peg their currencies. The second reason is basically a way of buying credibility. So a central bank that has suffered a lack of credibility, either through currency market volatility or through inflation volatility, may choose to peg a currency as a way of saying, look, we're really, really committed to our policy objectives and we're going to lash ourselves to the mast, as it were, by borrowing the credibility of the Federal Reserve or whichever central bank they choose. A small number of countries have pegged currencies because, frankly, it's not practical for them to have an independent currency. So if you think of some of the Caribbean islands using the dollar as a basis for their currencies, they are effectively saying, look, we'll manufacture some small change ourselves, but really, we have to accept that it's not practical for us to have a currency independently.
With an explanation of some more of the mechanics of how these pegs work is Jorge Mariscal, UBS Chief Investment Officer for the Emerging Markets.
Pegs obviously are common among major commodity exporters, particularly oil producers. They basically fix the parity of the exchange rate versus the US dollar in most cases, or a basket of currencies, as it is the case in China, for example. Essentially, that means that the central bank chooses the currency, but is unable to then set the level of interest rates as long as the capital markets are open.
And with a view from Zurich on the function of pegs, here's Simon Smiles, UBS Chief Investment Officer for Ultra High Net Worth.
Well, peg currencies exist for a range of reasons. Where you've got a dollarized or predominantly dollarized economy, it makes sense to have stability versus the US dollar, which at the end of the day remains the global reserve currency. In other areas, pegs or floors were put in place for very different reasons. For example, the 120 floor that was in place for the Swiss franc for a period of time until January 15th last year, that was very much put in place to withstand the ever-appreciating trend that had been in place for a number of years before. And in that case, it was about protecting the domestic economy from that strengthening currency. So two examples where the rationale is very different, but the effect was relatively similar. In terms of how they're actually managed, the central banks, it often falls to them. The Swiss National Bank had to intervene, in size in the market to maintain the floor with the Swiss peg. It's part of the reason that last year, on January 15th, they abandoned that with the expectation the European Central Bank would be engaging further quantitative easing. That led to an untenable situation where too much money would have to be printed and there'd be too much expansion of the balance sheet for the Swiss National Bank. Conversely, in a place like Hong Kong, you've got monetary authorities, the HKMA, which has managed that peg to the US dollar for an extended period of time. Again, the mechanism similar, though, intervening in the market where needed to maintain the stability of the currency.
So that's the theory, but what about the practice? Well, in terms of drawbacks, explains Paul Donovan, in the contemporary space, all pegged currencies come at a cost.
In the modern world, pegged currencies, unless you have sort of completely dollarized your economy, as with the Caribbean, a pegged currency comes with a cost. So whatever the credibility issues and whatever the credibility enhancement of pegging your currency, the cost is there's always a risk that it will go. And that means that investors in the financial markets will always demand a certain risk premium. So typically what we find is with pegged currencies, there will be an additional cost in terms of slightly higher interest rates coming through, because investors are saying, yes, we believe that you're committed, we believe that this currency peg is going to stay, but if there's a 5% chance that it doesn't, we want to be compensated for that risk.
Another problem that Jorge Mariscal describes arises from flights to safety of capital increase, making sustaining pegs more complex.
As capital becomes more scarce, like we're witnessing today, a flight to safety, capital outflows in most emerging economies, certainly those that are dependent on commodities, in order to sustain the peg, interest rates have to automatically rise. And as those interest rates go up, then the premium paid to be in those currencies increases and therefore reduces the pressure on the currency. So there's an automatic stabilization mechanism by virtue of interest rates moving up as capital flows increase. In a country that does not have a peg, you naturally would see, as capital flows happen, a depreciation of the exchange rate. Sometimes it's both a depreciation of the exchange rate and an increase in interest rates, but the impact is shared by the exchange rate and other variables.
Jorge Mariscal. Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look back to 1992 and the sterling crisis and ERM collapse. Plus, we'll gauge how investors should deal with those pegged currencies that remain. We look to a case study from history next, involving the European exchange rate mechanism and Black Wednesday in 1992, when the British government was forced to withdraw sterling from the ERM. Sebastian Salek of Bloomberg looks back to Black Wednesday and explains what the ERM, a precursor to the euro, taught us.
It was an early experiment. We call it semi-pegging because there was a range between it. And it's a sort of a precursor to the euro, where all the currencies in Europe, they're not pegged to each other. They are the same currency. So you have that regularity, that uniformity. And you see what happens today with Switzerland. Switzerland's still not part of the euro. They use the Swiss franc. And they had to devalue their currency massively about a year ago. And that caused massive havoc in the markets because they couldn't keep buying up other currencies to be able to keep the Swiss franc at the level that they wanted and that they needed for their exports. It's a hugely export-driven economy. But going back to Black Wednesday, it's really a lesson in where things go wrong. We saw the UK try to join the exchange rate mechanism and it just couldn't hack the commitments. And as a result, we had currency speculators that came in. They betted that the project would fail, essentially, and they profited massively from it as a result. And it was a huge hit to the UK taxpayer.
We asked Paul Donovan, too, for his recollections of Black Wednesday.
I was there. I was working in the financial markets. I had just started at UBS when sterling left the exchange rate mechanism. It wasn't my fault. Currency pegs that succeed generally have fairly solid fundamental reasons why they are pegged. So if we look at the Middle Eastern currencies, in for most Middle Eastern states, the economy of most Middle Eastern states is dollar-based because it's oil-based. And that means pegging to the US dollar is not necessarily a particularly unorthodox approach. The problem for the UK in 1992 was it just wasn't credible. The monetary policy of the Eurozone, or what's now the Eurozone, which was then the EU, was requiring tightening when the UK required easing, or at least didn't require the same tightening as other European countries. And the pay was being inflicted on UK mortgage payers because of the mortgage structure was huge. The UK just wasn't synchronized with the rest of Europe. It didn't need a common policy. And the second key issue in the UK is in 1992, and indeed subsequently, the UK is a democracy. And you tend to find that pegged exchange rates, with one or two exceptions, do not do well in democracies because the pain that periodically comes with a pegged exchange rate in economic terms provokes a political reaction in a democratic country. So when we look at the more successful regimes, they tend to be countries where democratic pressures are somewhat less than was the case in the UK in 1992.
So why did the UK peg to the ERM unravel? What fundamentally did the UK get wrong? It was all about timing, explained Sebastian again.
I mean, I think it was really a question of timing. You look at the state of the UK economy at the time, inflation was pretty high. It was three times the rate of Germany's, which was the currency, the Deutschmark, that the pound was pegged to. Interest rates were at 15%. You saw a double deficit in the UK. The US dollar was depreciating a lot, and a lot of British exports were priced in US dollars. So it was a very bad time. time to join in retrospect. And I think this is what the currency speculators like George Soros, the man who really created the damage there, saw. And currency speculators, it's their job to try and predict the move of a currency and make money off it. And in this case, they saw the pound dropping. And so they put a short on the pound. This is essentially when you bet on the value of something falling. You can do it with a stock. You can do it with any asset. Here, it was the pound. And the deal here is, if you're a member of the ERM and your currency drops below a certain bound, you have to leave the ERM. And when that happens, your currency is going to drop. And that's exactly what played out here. George Soros made this bet. He got it right. And he made a huge amount of money. I mean, we're talking about, I think the Treasury estimated the cost to be £3.4 billion. And this is coming out of taxpayers' pockets. So it was a huge hit to the British public. And we saw the recession that played out shortly beforehand and afterwards. And politically as well, it was a huge move. The trust in the Conservative government at the time just went. They dropped in the polls. And a few years later, 5 years later in 1997, Tony Blair won that election for Labour and was in power for another 14 years.
Now, Sebastian mentioned George Soros there. He was very much the headline act. But was the sterling crisis all about one man, or was he just the understandably identifiable face of this tumultuous day?
You've got to be pretty smart to clock something like this. I mean, this is a man who he outsmarted the British government, essentially. I think the reason why it was so exciting was that on that morning, on the 15th of September, 92, he started his assault. He started selling off the pounds. And the government, the Treasury and the Bank of England were working together to try to counteract it. They were trying to encourage people to buy the pound. They increased the interest rates, the base rate for the Bank of England from 10% to 12%. That sort of move isn't something you make lightly, and they made it as a more or less snap decision. And when interest rates go up, typically currencies go up. So what they were hoping to do was offset this sell-off, offset the falling pound and bring it back up again. And it wasn't working. And so they promised to raise it again to 15%, you know, a 5% hike in interest rates in one day within a few hours is a huge deal. And it's something that really gets the markets moving. But even that promise, I think the markets saw what was effectively a double bluff. And it just wasn't enough to offset what Soros was doing. So, you know, he was the main player in this. And I think that's why, as you say, the headlines jumped on it so much. But just, you know, as a currency speculator, to take on a whole country and to win, that's what makes this story as big as it is.
A case study of Black Wednesday and the ERM. In the contemporary setting, though, what are some of the pressures? What can go wrong? And why do volatile markets cause problems? Here's Jorge Mariscal again.
Well, what can go wrong is, of course, that the political and social pressures in countries with pegs increase more than in countries with floating exchange rates. Because, as I said, in a country with a floating exchange rate, part of the burden is shared by a weaker currency. So as the currency weakens, exports become more competitive and the country does a little bit better. So on the margin, the real blow to the economy is lessened. In countries that commit to pegs, there is not that option. As interest rates rise, the economy slows down and you don't get the relief of a more competitive exchange rate that could promote your exports because the peg stays. Then the full blow occurs on the economy. So the impact on employment, the impact on economic activity overall has social and political implications. So pegs have to be much more willing to deal with those consequences than countries that float their exchange rates.
And how would Simon Smiles sum up essentially what can go wrong?
Mr. Market is where things go wrong, where you've got a huge speculative pressure on the peg forcing the central bank to engage in ever-increasing amounts of intervention to maintain the peg. You know, these things can break. Again, last year we saw that with the Swiss National Bank having to abandon the floor on the Swiss franc in light of the expectation of further European Central Bank intervention. In the more recent past, the Hong Kong Monetary Authority has not abandoned the Hong Kong dollar peg, but that has come under significant pressure. You've had the People's Bank of China change the mechanism by which the renminbi is fixed, in part because of the huge speculation that was in place. And you've had speculation that various petro pegs, such as the Saudi rial peg, would break. And in fact, forwards in that market are implying 2.5%+ depreciation, which is interesting given the peg itself has not broken.
Finally, on today's programme, we sought an overview of those pegs that are left, the Hong Kong dollar, Saudi rial, and so on, and insights into how investors should deal with them. Simon Smiles has been in these markets recently and has some useful perspectives.
Yeah, well, over the last 3 weeks, I've actually been in both Hong Kong as well as the Middle East, and of interesting times. 3 weeks ago in Hong Kong, there was a lot of speculation that the Hong Kong dollar peg would be broken, and in fact, it had traded to the very top end of its band. There, while there were concerns about the Hong Kong dollar peg potentially breaking, I think the general prevailing wisdom was that the Hong Kong Monetary Authority would maintain that pair. However, the means to do that may well involve increasing HIBOR rates, potentially significantly above LIBOR rates, and then the flow-on effects that would have for the Hong Kong property market were more where the concerns were focused, as distinct from strong views that the Hong Kong dollar peg would break per se. In the Middle East, more interesting. The majority of people that I saw in Saudi Arabia still expected that the peg would be maintained despite the speculative pressure. And the people who had that view, you know, pointed often to the past. The late 90s were another period where there was significant pressure on the peg and the authorities were able to see through that pressure and maintain it. And so hence history in this case being seen as a lesson for the current situations, and particularly given the reserves that Saudi continues to have, they saw this time as being no different to the past. However, there was a minority of people I saw who were much more concerned about the Saudi peg going. The concern being that while it might be a small probability, if indeed Saudi Arabia was to ban its peg and depreciate its currency significantly, that would have significant implications for the wealth that had accrued in Saudi assets, be it real estate or indeed in Saudi equities. And hence for those clients, they were looking at ways to potentially hedge that risk, however small the probability, and also very interested in how in external assets, assets which weren't real-based, assets in the US, assets in Europe that they could potentially divest into.
And that's Simon Smiles bringing us to the end of this 71st edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.